Hi, my name is Bryant Mangum of the English Department of Virginia Commonwealth University, and today we're going to be talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story, Babylon Revisited. F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote his brilliant short story, Babylon Revisited, in December of 1930, at the end of what was probably the worst year of his life, only months after his wife, Zelda, had had her first major emotional breakdown. In the last years of her life, even the last 15 years, she had had numerous breakdowns, and during this time, Fitzgerald continued to work hard, both to provide money that would allow Zelda to have the best psychiatric help available, and also to provide her psychiatrist with information that would aid in her cure. At the same time, Fitzgerald was struggling with his own alcoholism. But also, one of the paradoxical things here is that Fitzgerald was also caught up in the exotic aspects of Zelda's illness and even in the self-destructive parts of their relationship. At one point, Zelda's psychiatrist asked Fitzgerald to describe what he thought had caused Zelda's mental collapse, and he wrote the psychiatrist this: "Her friends would tell you that my drinking drove her to insanity. My friends would tell you that her insanity drove me to drink. All of these friends would agree that each of us would be well rid of the other, in full face of the irony that Zelda and I have never been so desperately in love with each other. The truth," he said, "is that liquor in my mouth is sweet to her, and I cherish her most extravagant hallucinations." For his part, Fitzgerald's going on the wagon often simply meant that, in fact, he would swear off of hard liquor, but would continue to consume vast quantities of beer and wine, which suggests, in a sense, his commitment to helping her. I mention this background not to establish a definite link between events in Fitzgerald's life and specific details of the story Babylon Revisited, but rather to illustrate the idea which is perhaps most important to understanding Fitzgerald's life in his fiction, the concept of double vision. On the one hand, Fitzgerald was able, in the circumstance of Zelda's mental illness and his own alcoholism, to analyze these conditions critically and objectively. In fact, he wrote Zelda's psychiatrist hundreds of thousands of words on the conditions of Zelda's illness and his own alcoholism. But it's also clear that Fitzgerald was actively involved in perpetuating their terribly self-destructive relationship. Double vision is the ability to immerse oneself in experience at the level of the senses and yet to be able to stand back at the same time and analyze these experiences critically and objectively. At one point, Fitzgerald made the comment that the test of a first-rate intelligence was the ability to hold two opposite ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. Double vision is an outgrowth of that kind of intelligence, and it is this that provides Babylon Revisited with its extraordinary power. The most obvious way that Fitzgerald draws the reader into Babylon Revisited at the level of feeling is through carefully constructing a conflict between Charles J. Wales of Prague in the 1930s and those forces that are associated with the past of Charlie Wales, who lived in Paris in the 1920s. In this conflict, who could possibly fail to feel sympathy for Charlie, who in the 20s lost his wife, he lost his money, he became an alcoholic, was confined to a sanitarium, and ultimately lost custody of his daughter, Honoria? Who could fail to feel sympathy for him, and who could possibly fail to, in a sense, feel that he would defeat those forces that are represented by his sister-in-law, Marion, who would like to keep his daughter, Honoria, away from him? Honoria's childhood is almost over, and we wish Charlie well in regaining custody of her before her childhood is over, as he calls it. Working against this force of his reformed character are the ghosts of the past that continue to haunt him. One of these, obviously, is the imprudent act of locking his wife, Helen, out in the snow, an act that his sister-in-law, Helen, will never seem to forgive him of. None of the things that Fitzgerald presents in the form of external forces really seem to be actually the fault of the Charles J. Wales that we see in this story. In each of the five sections of the story, there's a delicate balance of the strength of Wales' resolve in the present and the heavy weight of the past over which he seems to have no control. In the first of the five sections, we have an opening in the Ritz bar, and of course this is the point to which the story will return at the end. But against this past that we see in that first scene, we have Charlie's triumphant visit to the home of his sister and brother-in-law, the Peters, where he's able to show them that he has in fact reformed, that he's made money, that he's potentially a very good parent for Honoria. In the second scene, Charlie is shown in a long scene with his daughter Honoria as being a very good father, but in the midst of this breakfast that they have together, there is the arrival of Duncan and Lorraine, who continue, of course, to haunt Charlie throughout the story, and in this particular scene, wind up, to a degree, luring him away from his quest for Honoria. The third scene, which seems to set up the climax that will come in the fourth scene, in this third scene, Charlie visits the Peters home and appears to have everything under control. His sister-in-law has agreed, in effect, to let him take Honoria back to Prague with him. And yet, when Charlie returns to his hotel that night, the past returns again in the form of dreams. His wife Helen appears in that horrible scene where he locks her out in the snow. The fourth scene has apparently set up the climax, at which point we expect that Charlie will be triumphant and that he'll be able to return to Prague with his daughter Honoria. But as he goes to the home of the Peters to, in a sense, claim his prize, there is the unforeseen appearance of the drunken Dunk and Lorraine, who have of course been friends of his from the Paris of the 1920s. And so in effect, the climatic scene, which could have been Charlie's taking of Honoria back to Prague, perhaps the first stage of it would have occurred on that very day, is undercut, sabotaged by the reappearance of those ghosts from the past. The fifth scene returns to the Ritz bar where the story had opened. Charlie appears in that final scene to have maintained his resolve not to drink. He drinks his one drink and then he leaves the bar, but before he does, the bartender from the Paris of the 20s, Paul, appears and reminds not only Charlie but the reader of the past that Charlie cannot seem to forget. Conventional wisdom has it that Babylon Revisited is Fitzgerald's most brilliantly conceived story. And by conventional wisdom, I simply mean a kind of consensus of critical opinion. There have been some 120 journal articles, book chapters written on Babylon Revisited, and there's virtual agreement among critics that Babylon Revisited is Fitzgerald's finest story. Charles, as the critics seem all to agree, is a reformed alcoholic, a man who has every reason to deserve that he'll regain custody of his daughter Honoria. He's a man who's worked hard to get to this point to reclaim the good things that he once had. And only circumstance, according to this general critical consensus, only circumstances have kept him from getting this prize in the form of Honoria. Most of these critics maintain that anyone who reads Babylon Revisited with any degree of sensitivity will see this point and will understand that this is what the story is about. One commentator sums it up in this way. "The story's meaning is clear," he says. "It has some symbols, but they're not mysterious. Some ambiguity, but it is not hidden. Considerable irony, but it is readily discernible. It strikes us, in short, as an example of the really excellent story that is widely read and reread, usually with considerable appreciation and understanding." This observation is interesting on one level because it attests to the artistic brilliance of Babylon Revisited, even at the most superficial level, but it does not really do justice to the depth and complexity of the story. Particularly, it does not do justice to the double vision that is operating in Babylon Revisited. This double vision allows Fitzgerald to present another side of Charles Wales' story. It's a side that's much more painful, it's closer to tragic than it is to sad or pitiful. It's the story of a man whose destructive, unconscious drives actually work to overcome what are his stated conscious wishes for the present. At the level of the second story, Charlie is sowing the seeds of his own destruction. When one looks back and remembers the first scene, Charlie has left with the bartender in the Ritz bar his address, or actually the address of the Peters, where he can be found, for his old friend, Dunk Schaefer. And of course, the idea is that Dunk Schaefer will look him up if he comes to Paris. But of course, what Charlie should have realized is that he might well have shown up drunk, which in fact he does, and in effect sabotages Charlie's opportunity to regain Honoria. There are many other instances where Fitzgerald shows that Charlie is, at least on some level, perhaps and probably a deeply unconscious level, very much wishing to undermine his own success. There is, for example, the business of Charlie's alcoholism. Clearly, he was once an alcoholic, and yet he insists to the present time on drinking a single drink a day, which he, of course, maintains will allow him not to see liquor as too large a force in his life. But the fact is that he is very much flirting with danger. There's also the business of his companions as he's in Paris. For one thing, he spends time with a prostitute, even though he simply buys her a meal. At one point, and this is an action of Charlie's that is seems very much questionable, he runs into Dunk and Lorraine when he and Honoria are having breakfast. He tells them that they're going to a vaudeville at the Empire Theater, knowing full well that Lorraine and Duncan may follow him to the theater, and in fact they do, and Charlie agrees to have a drink with them. Over and over again, Charlie does things in this story that suggest that his unconscious is trying to work to undermine what are his consciously stated motives and wishes of regaining custody of Honoria. Now, there are many ways that you could explain these actions of Charlie. Some of them are obvious, some of them not so obvious, many of them with firm support in the text. On one level, it appears that Charlie is still infatuated with the old life, the life that he led in Paris in the 1920s. When he's talking to his sister-in-law, of all people, he tells her this about the old life. He says, "It was nice while it lasted. We were sort of royalty, almost infallible, with a sort of magic around us." Now, another explanation for Charlie's behavior is that he simply cannot forgive himself of locking his wife out in the snow and perhaps contributing to her death. It's possible, and it seems in many ways probable, that his unconscious undermining of the regaining of Honoria is something that he does in order to punish himself, perhaps, because he's unable to forgive himself for that act. Or it could be much simpler. Charlie could simply have become victim to this old force that Edgar Allan Poe referred to as the imp of the perverse, the force that will lead even the most normal of us to the top of a high building and cause us to look down and wonder what it might be like to jump. This, of course, is generally an impulse that is quickly in passing, and few of us succumb to it. We all know, of course, that the unconscious mind can work in the way that Charlie seems to work in this story. We need only to think of the story of Oedipus, who spends most of his life in fear of this prophecy that he will grow up and kill his father and marry his mother. As members of the audience watching Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, we gaze in horror as Oedipus, on coming to a crossroads, discovers an older man who is at the crossroads and kills him, little knowing, at least according to Oedipus, that it is his father. And then we again watch in horror as he marries a much older woman, Jocasta, who is in fact his mother. We know in that story that something deep is working within the mind of Oedipus, much the way that something deep and deeply unconscious seems to be working in the psyche of Charlie Wales. One of the strongest hints that Babylon Revisited is dealing with these darker forces in Charlie's personality is found in a very early version of the story, the one that appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. In that version, Fitzgerald has Lorraine, when she appears at the Peters house, say this to Charlie. She says, "Come on out to dinner. she's speaking to Charlie. She says, be yourself, implying, of course, that the good self that Charlie has shown us in this story and shown the Peters is really not his full self or his actual self. When Fitzgerald revised this story for Taps at Reveille, he took this line out, perhaps because he wanted to suggest as subtly as possible the way in which unconscious motives work, and perhaps did not want to make this level of the story obvious. He took this out of the version Taps at Reveille, and in the process showed that the unconscious motivation of Charlie is very subtle. In Babylon Revisited, Fitzgerald's double vision allows him to see in life and in its recreation in literature that people do things to sabotage their conscious wishes. Babylon Revisited is a story of Charles J. Wales of Prague versus Charlie Wales of Paris. And we may leave this story wishing that the best man will win, but we cannot, after reading Babylon Revisited, we cannot be so certain that this will happen, as Fitzgerald might say, this side of paradise.